on the fracking debate. He says to harm the earth is to heap contempt on the creator. And Jabber has been tweeting us about Rob Craig's audio diary from Rwanda. He says, an insightful audio diary from the moderator looking at genocide in Rwanda. As you heard earlier, Rob Craig has just returned from an official visit to Rwanda. Also on that visit were the Reverend Dr. Leslie Carroll and the Victims Commissioner, Catherine Stone. So what did they learn about dealing with the past and with about healing old wounds in a country, let's just remember this, a country where just 20 years ago nearly 1 million people were slaughtered in just 100 days. Let's hear first from Dr. Rob Craig.
First of all, can I say I went with the Presbyterian Church in Ireland to learn something of the development work being carried on by our partners, Tear Fund and Christian Aid. But it's impossible to look at the development work going on and not think of the context in Rwanda, a context of horrific conflict in 1994, and a sense that there is hope in Rwanda, that the country has doing its best to move forward and is taking strides to move forward to rebuild a new society. I think the little bit that I learned and understand is that there's very clear differences, maybe as to the reasons for the conflict, but that there are some lessons to be drawn out from it. Some of the differences have to do with the, you know, as we understand it, Hutus and Tutsis were maybe divided more socially rather than on ethnic grounds, and therefore there's a difference there. I think the lessons that we learned were, well, on the one hand, people were asking, first of all, where is the church? They felt at the time the church let them down in their moment of crisis, but they felt since that the church has been very much a part of the healing process, so that representatives of the church went into prisons, bringing with them the Christian message of forgiveness and repentance and a new start. So that's, I think, there are lessons for the church in that. One interesting thing that wouldn't carry over is that in their rural society, they had a lot of, if you like, village courts where they could conduct trials, because the whole legal system just collapsed within the country because of the conflict. These village courts might have been used to originally to settle neighbour disputes over land or relationships and things like that, but they were used in a way that never been used before to settle conflict. And it was a way in which people could come forward and admit and confess their crimes and find some measure of forgiveness and healing with their neighbours. And, you know, that was certainly one of the things that stayed with me and struck me.
Leslie Carroll, what stands out from what you saw during your visit to Rwanda?
I think one of the things that stands out for me is the strength of the leadership, and that at government level and also from within civil society, very much though focused within the church. And it occurred to me then, as I reflected back on that, that we all choose, conflicted societies, choose our way out of a conflict. And it could be bad or it could be good, but it is what it is because it's what works for us. And therefore, what becomes important as we move forward into further peace resolution is that we learn to be transformative in that, because nothing is perfect. So we in Northern Ireland have not chosen that very strong leadership mechanism. We've chosen a more collaborative mechanism. We choose to negotiate with each other to try to bring each other along. Whereas in Rwanda, it's very strong from the top down. Now, very strong from the top down works to a certain degree. It'll take you so far, but there are also always going to be other voices that need to be heard. So there needs to be something transformative in there for them, for us, in our much more negotiated, collaborative, slow, tedious sometimes process. We need to have a transformative mechanism that assists stronger leadership at times to move us on to the next thing. So that kind of reflection seemed to me to be useful and help me to deal with some of the frustrations that I might feel here in Northern Ireland.
Catherine, what about the victims' issues in Rwanda? Big differences, obviously, but I suspect also some similarities.
Well, the scale of the genocide in Rwanda was just almost unimaginable. But in a very similar way to Northern Ireland, the indomitable spirit of the people shone through. And so many groups and organisations grew out of complete necessity. We went to visit one organisation, which is an association of genocide widows. And that organisation told us about the experiences of women who had adopted many children that they'd never met before, children of of people who had been killed. And what they said, very poignant, was if we had been lost, we would have wanted to know that someone was caring for our children. And so we will care for these children. We have no money, but we have love, and we will care for these children. And that's what they did. And it was incredible to see that spirit, that sense of community, that sense of hopefulness, that sense of determination that this will never, ever, ever happen again in Rwanda. One of the things that was said to us, which was equally poignant, and this was from one of our Tear Fund colleagues in Rwanda, and he said, "Catherine, we speak of hope while standing on bones." Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an incredibly moving thing for him to say. So a very complex set of circumstances, but people working in partnership with Tear Fund, with Christian Aid, with other organisations who are absolutely determined to provide the very best they can in situation of absolute poverty. I can't begin to describe the poverty to you, but the spirit of the people there was absolutely core to the recovery.
Catherine, we've talked a lot on this programme about mechanisms for dealing with the past, truth and reconciliation processes, and we've discussed South Africa, Guatemala. There are 30, 40 different processes in the world. Some are judicial, some are more storytelling, top down, bottom up. Our audience has been across a lot of this. How are they doing it in Rwanda?
Well, Leslie's already spoken about the very strong leadership, which says whatever our differences about education or environment or economy, we are one Rwanda. We are all Rwandan people. And that's the way that the kind of bigger picture narrative is set. But the other thing that struck me about how they are promoting unity and reconciliation, as it's described in Rwanda, is the way in which children are educated. Unity and reconciliation are part of a core curriculum. There is no segregated education at all. Children are taught about the causes of the genocide, the impact of the genocide, and how hard they must work now to make sure that the unity and reconciliation is a very important part of the total society. So the way they do it is both bottom up and top down, if you like. And it was very inspiring to see the way in which the children were completely wanting to promote unity and reconciliation, and gave us some very warm, very descriptive pictures of the Rwanda they want to live in.
Well, what you've all described so far, leadership, political leadership, integrated education, challenging segregation, a common sense of national identity. We're no longer Hutus and Tutsis, we are Rwandans. Leslie, they are all major differences from where we are. We've often had a situation where people criticise a lack of political leadership. We are a segregated society in so many ways, and we certainly do not have a common sense of national identity.
That's all very true. But we also need to take care not to give the impression that we don't know what we're doing, or that we haven't journeyed some distance, or that we're not going to get any further here. So, for example, during the week in Rwanda, we heard they set aside a time each year to focus on reconciliation. And they set aside a time each year to focus on remembering those who died.
Is that a day of reconciliation?
It's a week, and then there's further time for remembering. So somewhere about the middle of the week, I was saying to myself, this is really good that they take this time to do this. It's terrible we have nothing like that in Northern Ireland. And then I thought, wait a minute, we have the Day of Reflection. We have Community Relations Week. It's not that we don't have mechanisms. We're just not using them very well. So on the one hand, I don't want us to do ourselves down and begin to say to ourselves, well, we don't know what we're doing, we don't know where we're going, we don't know where we're come from, it's all going to fall apart, because that need not necessarily be the case.
What about the role of the media? How have they played a role, different or similar to our media here?
Well, the media would be fairly strongly controlled. So an act was passed in 2009, which put even more restrictions on how the media functions in Rwanda. The media function very much to serve the national vision of unity and reconciliation. And that has a real strength to it. So there's no critical element really there in terms of where the government is leading this at this point. It doesn't feel very much like a free press, no. Nevertheless, I mean, that's a kind of natural Western criticism that it's not a free press. Nevertheless, you have to get a society from circumstances in which upwards on 1 million people died over 100 days into a new situation. And that's what I mean when I was talking earlier about transformative mechanisms. You put in place what you can and what you need to get you from where you were to a new place, but you need to put more mechanisms in place to move you on in order that the old oppressive regimes don't reoccur. So the media may have had to play this part at this point in time, but they need to be careful they're going into the future.
It's an amazing sentence, that, isn't it, Rob? 1 million people in 100 days.
It's very hard to get your mind around it. Maybe I could just say that on the first day, the first thing we did was to visit the genocide memorial. And, I mean, I've visited Auschwitz and I've visited Yad Vashem, so I was putting it in that context. And they have it in three sections. Rwanda before the genocide, the experience of the genocide, and then the third section is Rwanda after the genocide. And my older daughter was with us, and she came out, and being a typical father trying to be protective, but she came out and she said, "There's hope here, Dad." You know, and then on the what was meant to be our free day on the Saturday, we decided to head up country and visit two Catholic churches where we had heard that terrible massacres had taken place. And some of the things that we heard were unspeakable. These poor people went to their churches in the hope that they would find sanctuary there. The context is that there'd been a kind of a dress rehearsal for the genocide in 92. And when they went to the churches on that occasion, they found sanctuary. But when they went in 94, they didn't find it. And they've been left not as, if you like, living churches where people gather for worship, but as living memorials. And very difficult and very harrowing. And I think another thing I would have to say in that context, and I suppose that when we think of places like Egypt and Syria that are in the news at the moment, while I would have been unaware of what was happening in Rwanda in 1994, the international community was not unaware. Mm-hmm. And I think people now look back with a sense of, we wished we'd done it differently. That they stood back when they might have stepped in. That's just a statement about life in general.
But has it affected your attitude to what we're now seeing in Syria?
Well, I suppose it just makes me realise how powerless at times the international community can be, how difficult they find it to speak with one voice for lots of reasons that may be good or bad, that are maybe their vested interests, so that some want to act and some don't want to act. And there's this constant tension, and there's almost a hand-wringing on the sides. And in the meantime, it's not governments, it's people, husbands, fathers, mothers, wives, children who are suffering. But I know to step in could make a bad situation worse. It's just a very difficult moral situation.
It's complicated. And maybe you've been following on Twitter this week. Richard Haass, the peace envoy, who's coming here hopefully to fix all our problems, has been calling for military strikes in Syria all week.
It's just one more. Interesting, in the Genocide Museum, they had a particular room to talk about really 20th century genocides. And they started with the Armenians and Turkey at the start of the 20th century, coming right up to the Balkans and then into Rwanda itself. It's interesting that sort of there's Richard Haass on the one hand calling for strikes and coming to bring us peace. It's a strange paradox.
Church leaders in Northern Ireland have been criticised over the years, and churches generally, about their role in the Troubles, whether they did enough. John Brewer, you'll have heard him on this programme many times, saying the churches ran away from the Troubles. When you look at Rwanda and the role that some church leaders played there, some implicated very significantly in the genocide, what's been the impact of that story emerging on the state of religion within Rwanda today?
Strangely, I had this thought in my mind that when there's a real disaster, even a natural disaster, people, especially in the West, often ask, where is God? And in Rwanda, the question they asked is, where is the church? Now, on the Sunday, the one Sunday that we were there and we attended church, as we drove to church, it reminded me almost of the Northern Ireland that I knew 40 and 50 years ago, to see so many people out in the street with some kind of Bible or prayer book or hymn book under their arm, and they were going to their place of worship. Interestingly, Rwanda is certainly not a Western secular state. I can only go by the little glimpse that I saw. There seemed to be not only plenty of church buildings, but plenty of people going to church. And we visited one church that is partnering with a Presbyterian church here, White House in Belfast, and this church didn't exist at the time of the genocide, and they now have a vibrant congregation. They have a nursery and a primary and a secondary school part of their complex as they're trying to invest in the future of their children. But they also have four or five satellite congregations out into rural Rwanda. So despite all that the people have come through, they have not turned away from church and they've not turned away from God. And yes, the stories we heard were that some church leaders, sadly, were implicated in the genocide.
Catherine, again, we often talk about victims in Northern Ireland, many of whom feel like they've been left out of the political peace process, they've been forgotten, they've become an inconvenience, they're in the way of some political progress. That's how they feel, many of them. How do victims feel in Rwanda, those you spoke to? Do they feel included or do they feel sometimes isolated and left out?
That's a very interesting question. And one of the things that I was very keen to find out about was the ways in which victims' needs are met as a whole person. And obviously, where there has been such a terrible, terrible event and so many lives have been lost, then the priority has to be practical things, shelter, food, water, so on and so forth. And one of the things I think that our colleagues in Rwanda would accept is that there now needs to be a greater focus on people's mental health and their emotional well-being. And one of the things that is something very positive about the work that's being done in Northern Ireland is that there are so many groups who are focusing on supporting people's mental health, having a real understanding of things like post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic mental health conditions. And I think what we can do is to say that while they might be building the peace very successfully in Rwanda, they also now need to start thinking about how to build peace of mind for people. And it was very interesting to have those conversations about how people's mental health is supported, how people are supported to recover mentally from their experiences. Because, you know, if we as a group of visitors for a very short time felt very challenged by the unimaginable horror that we were seeing in front of us and explained, and the memorial sites that we were seeing, goodness alone knows what it must have been like to live through that experience.
Horrendous, yeah.
Absolutely horrendous. And, you know, we met with older teenagers and young adults who had never known their parents. You know, their parents were killed in 1994 and they'd never met them. So, truly terrible place, but as Rob said, a hopeful place as well.
Oh my goodness, Leslie, put some of our conflict in context, doesn't it?
Absolutely. One of the phrases, William, that we saw and heard on a number of occasions was standing in their gap. We heard that phrase from the widows group that Catherine's spoken about, and we saw it written on the wall at some of the memorial sites. And that I think...
And what do people mean by that, standing in their gap?
So in the widows group, for example, when they were talking about taking on the orphans of those who had been killed, there was a sense of we're standing in their gap. We're living a life that will bear witness to the life that these people would have lived. It's a very interesting concept, but I think what it said to me was that society across Rwanda were taking ownership of the recovery. So people were willing to step in and stand in the gap. There was no standing back and allowing somebody else to take responsibility. Yeah. People were stepping in there, and that real sense of ownership of moving Rwanda from where it has been to somewhere considerably better. That was impressive.
Well, after all that devastation, genocidal devastation, I'm detecting hope from all of you in what you saw. And I think that's accurate, isn't it? For those of us who have never been to Rwanda and who might experience this for ourselves someday and hope to learn a little bit for our own situation, let's just end by asking you all to give us a take-home message, the take-home message from Rwanda for you that you'd like to pass on, if you could waft this about a bit in Northern Ireland and like magical dust across our situation and hopefully learn a little bit. What would it be, Rob?
Well, you're looking at me. I speak first.
I always look at you first, moderator.
Yeah. One of the words that comes to my mind is that we often talk here about demonising people. And that certainly happened in Rwanda, where the Tutsis were referred to as cockroaches. And I just come away with that sense of I don't ever want to be a part of demonising another person. I want to see another person as someone made in God's image. We might see things differently. We mightn't agree. But they're precious in God's sight. And I don't want to be part of that kind of language and that kind of attitude.
Yeah. And it starts with the language, doesn't it? It starts with the language with the Jews yeah. as well in that attempt at genocide. Mm-hmm. And we have that kind of language problem in Northern Ireland. It's very easy to stomp on a cockroach.
It is.
Not so easy to take the light out of the eyes of a real full human being. Yeah. Leslie, what's your lesson?
There's a Rwandan proverb that goes something like, when we join hands, we can lift elephants. We can do it. We can change the world.
Catherine.
One of our Rwandan colleagues said to us, no one benefited from the genocide here. Killers, victims, no one benefited. Everyone hurts and no one wins. And that was something that really, really struck me as I came away.
Victims Commissioner Catherine Stone, the Reverend Dr. Leslie Carroll and the Presbyterian moderator Dr. Rob Craig on the lessons we could learn from the Rwandan genocide. And you're texting us this morning on 81771.